Welcome to Food for Thought Podcast. My name is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. I'm your host. Today's episode is gut-wrenching. Common words with surprising animal origins. Before we begin, just a quick note to let you know, you can find me at joyfulvegan.com. You can find me on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Thank you so much for subscribing to Food for Thought, and thank you for sharing Food for Thought with others, for leaving ratings and reviews, and for supporting it. Food for Thought is a 100% listener-supported podcast, so you can join other listeners in supporting this podcast and receiving the podcast transcripts, as well as other bonuses and perks by going to patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau. Thank you so much in advance. I have noticed, I don't know if you've noticed, but there are three other podcasts now named Food for Thought, and this has only been in the last year or so. This Food for Thought podcast has been going on since 2006. So this is the OG Food for Thought podcast. But thank you for leaving ratings and reviews. I really appreciate it. We have had to officially put our June 2020 trip on hold because of COVID-19. But I still encourage you to go over to worldvegantravel.com and join the mailing list. As you know, I host vegan trips around the world with my partners, Bridie and Seb, over at World Vegan Travel. And we will absolutely be hosting these trips again. Our South Africa, Botswana, December 2020 trip is still on. And we've got many more amazing trips planned for 2021, 2022, and beyond. I think at the end of all of this, we'll all need a vacation, we'll all need to get away, and we'll certainly all need a way to support compassionate businesses that don't exploit animals. And that's what our trips are all about. One more thing, Bridie and Seb, World Vegan Travel, have their own podcast now called the World Vegan Travel Podcast. So please go listen to them and subscribe so you can hear them talk all about vegan travel experiences. In the meantime, until I see you on a trip, but even after that, even after COVID-19 isn't ruling and ruining our lives, you can join me because these classes are going to go on for a long time, even when this is over. You can join me from wherever you are in my online cooking classes that I've been hosting each and every week. The classes are interactive, they're fun, they're in real time, and they're pretty fancy schmancy. We've got a multi-camera setup. You can watch me talk and answer your questions, and you can see the food at the same time in a split screen view. You get your recipes in advance in case you want to cook along with me, which I have to say is the cutest thing to see. It's so lovely to see everybody, not everybody, but some people are in their aprons and they're in their kitchen and they're cooking along with me. So you get the recipes and the ingredients beforehand so you can cook along if you'd like to. You get a recording of our class at the end, a video recording of our class at the end. I pick a different theme each week and my husband David joins us at the end for the mixology portion of the classes where he shares how to make a cocktail. And we always try to have a mocktail variation related to the theme of the class. Coming up is For the Love of Whole Plant Foods, which features red lentil and cashew burgers, citrus kale salad with pine nuts, and no-bake apple crumble. And the week after that is Perfect Homemade Pizza, featuring Neapolitan pizza dough, tomato pizza sauce, and cashew cream drizzle. You can just go to joyfulvegan.com/events to register. That's always where the classes are. So even if you hear this podcast episode long after those classes have passed, that's where you'll find any of my events, any of my classes. And if you're a supporter, you receive 10% off the class. So do check your email, check your Patreon account for your discount code. So hi, everybody. I hope you're doing fabulously well. I have a really interesting episode for you. At least I find it interesting, and I hope you do too. As you know, I'm fascinated by etymology and the origins of English words, especially those that relate to animals. I call the animal-related words and expressions we use animologies, and today's episode is filled with animologies related to, there's no other way to put this, the consumption of animals, the slaughter of animals, really the flesh and fluids of animals, animal remains, animal guts. Okay, it sounds really gruesome. And yes, animal slaughter and consumption is pretty gruesome stuff, but this episode isn't about blood and gore. I mean, it is, but it's about the words you wouldn't know are about blood and gore. I'm not explaining this very well. When I say today's episode is about words built from animal flesh and animal fluids, I don't mean words that we use to talk about animal flesh and fluids. Like, I've already discussed these at length, words such as meat, milk, butter, and what those words connote and denote. Today, I'm flipping things around, and I hope I explain this well. I really struggled with the title for this episode. That's why I called it gut-wrenching, because this is, okay. So today's episode is about common words you would never know have animal-related roots that have to do with, you know, blood and guts, unless you dig deep, unless you listen to my podcast. So let me dive right in so you know what I mean. And I want to start with a word we use every day. Now, I want to be clear, I do try to warn listeners if there's something I think that would be really offensive or upsetting if you heard it on my podcast, which is very rare. I'm very proud of the fact that I know parents listen with their kids and you can listen whatever age you are. And it's very rare that you'd be surprised by something I said that you didn't know was coming. So even though that is the foundation of the episode today, kind of, you know, like the words that have to do with animal slaughter, I really don't think this is going to be any different than any other episode I've ever done, especially around language. Let me start with a word that we use every day and see if you know what I mean. See if you'll get the sense of kind of what we're doing here. So the word I want to start with is garbage. Today, in modern American usage, especially in America, the United States, the word garbage means worthless, useless, or unwanted matter. It's also called rubbish, which tends to be more of a UKism. Trash is another word. It's discarded waste matter. It's refuse. Now, we've broadened that word garbage from there to refer to anything that's contemptibly worthless, inferior, or vile. But if you think about how we refer to discarded kitchen waste, food waste, as garbage, you get closer to its original meaning. In its earliest usage, garbage referred specifically to the remains of an animal after having been slaughtered for human consumption. First attested in writing in 1430 in a cookery book, garbage was the name given to the leftover body parts of an animal, parts that weren't eaten, such as the head, the feet, and the entrails. It's what we would call offal, O-F-F-A-L, today. Even though I don't think that word is a very common word either. Slaughterhouse waste, I suppose we would say, although I think most people would prefer not to talk about it at all. And if you think that me talking about any of that is offensive, I would really encourage you to question the act itself rather than the words I'm talking about to refer to these acts, because that's really where the offense is that animals are systematically killed and what we have left over are body parts that we just throw away as garbage. By the 1580s, the word garbage began to be used in the more general sense to refer to refuse in general, not just specifically animal remains. And the origin of the word itself is unknown. Like, we don't know what the derivation of the word garbage is, though according to the Oxford English Dictionary, the OED, it's probably Anglo-French, like many other words found in early cookery books, but we don't know the actual derivation of that word, other than we know that the first time we see it is in the 1400s, and it refers specifically to slaughterhouse waste or butchery waste or the parts of the animal that we don't consume after the animal's been butchered. So there you have it. The word garbage is an animalogy. It's a word that's used in the general sense to refer to anything that's worthless, having come from the original use referring to the useless body parts of an animal that weren't eaten. And we still use it today to refer to food that goes uneaten and thus wasted. At this time, I'm going to shamefully point you to the past Food for Thought podcast episodes on food waste, why it's problematic, and how to avoid it. So no food is garbage, and certainly no animal is garbage. And I really encourage you to listen to those episodes on food waste. So you see, it's not so bad. Moving on to our next word that comes from animal flesh, even though you wouldn't know it or don't remember it or don't think about it when you hear it, and that's the word carnival. Now, of course, as soon as I say that, I'm sure you're saying to yourself, of course, carn means meat, it means flesh, as in the word carnivore, referring to any of various mammals of the order Carnivora, or flesh-eating animals. Carn means flesh, carn means meat. So let's examine this a little further. The word carnival, in general today, means some kind of show or display arranged as an amusement, or we think of it as some kind of traveling fair, having merry-go-rounds and other rides and games. We may also think of a carnival as a festive occasion or a festive period marked by merrymaking and processions, and more specifically, in some Roman Catholic countries and locales, it's the period just before Lent, Carnival. In this sense, carnival celebrations are indeed featured all around the world during this time, just before Lent, the most famous of which in the United States is in New Orleans, and it's more commonly referred to as Mardi Gras. Now, Mardi Gras means fat gras. Tuesday, Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday in French. Mardi Gras or Fat Tuesday is on the day before Ash Wednesday, which marks the beginning of Lent and thus prayer and fasting. And that's exactly what leads us to the origins of the word itself. The English word carnival is attested in writing in the late 1540s, but its Latin origins go back much further than that to an 11th century Latin phrase, carnem levare, and that became Italian, carne levare, meaning, very similar, meaning to remove meat, or more literally, to raise flesh, from Latin caro, which became carn, flesh, plus levare, lighten, raise, remove, meaning essentially the putting away or removal of flesh as food. In the Christian tradition, Lent is a 40-day period of fasting and penitence observed by many Christians in preparation for Easter. In Western churches, Lent lasts from, as I said, Ash Wednesday until Easter. The reason carne levare, the removing of meat, was even marked out as an expression to denote the time just before Lent is because during the Middle Ages, the consumption of meat, dairy, and eggs was forbidden during Lent. Over time, dispensations or exceptions were allowed for dairy, and so that became acceptable to eat during this fasting time. Eventually, eggs were allowed, and so they became part of the fast, which we're getting farther and farther away from a fast, whereas the original idea was for Catholics to abstain from consuming animal flesh every Friday throughout the year. If a special occasion or holiday, such as a wedding, fell on a Friday, you would be exempt. You could eat meat. Right, so that was every Friday throughout the year. And although the original doctrine was not to eat animal products at all during the 40 days between Ash Wednesday and essentially Good Friday, which is the Friday before Easter Sunday, by the time I was growing up and I grew up Catholic, we only had to abstain on Fridays. And eating fish was acceptable. So, in fact, so is animal fat in liquid form. We could eat chicken broth. We can eat any kind of liquefied animal product. In fact, here is what AmericanCatholic.org has to say about the rules for abstinence during Lent. Quote, abstinence does not include meat juices and liquid foods made from meat. Thus, such foods as chicken broth, consommé, soups cooked or flavored with meat, meat gravies or sauces, as well as seasonings or condiments made from animal fat are not forbidden. So it is permissible to use lard. Even bacon drippings, which contain little bits of meat, may be poured over lettuce as seasoning. I'm wondering, where would you get the bacon drippings if you're not consuming meat during Lent? So, although some Orthodox Christians still follow the earlier teachings to abstain from animal products altogether, clearly the bar is kept really low in terms of what's required of people. I talk about this in the 30-Day Vegan Challenge and elsewhere. We pick and choose the traditions we want to uphold. We justify the consumption of turkeys on Thanksgiving, eggs at Easter, and meat during Lent on the grounds of tradition, even though it really doesn't hold up. To authentically honor the traditions of this Christian holiday would mean to abstain from meat, dairy, and eggs entirely during Lent. And as we can see that in the word carnival, but rules have been relaxed to suit people's modern tastes and desires. The original tradition of abstaining from meat during Lent remains in our word carnival, because Lent was a period of fasting. It was a period of not consuming animal flesh during this time. The sense of carnival being a traveling amusement show dates back to the 1893 Columbian Exposition, the big World's Fair held in Chicago, which included an elaborate sideshow complete with rides. The first ever Ferris wheel was at that particular fair, the World's Fair in Chicago. Afterwards, Chicago's Midway turned into a portable experience. So there were traveling carnival companies bringing mechanical rides and games and concessions to towns across the country. Now, as I said, the root of the word carnival is the Latin word for flesh, carn, originally caro, and then carn for flesh. And in the word carnival, I think we can agree that the flesh refers specifically to animal flesh, not human flesh. It's not talking about abstaining from consuming human flesh. It's obviously talking about abstaining from consuming animal flesh. And we have other words where the root carn, meat, flesh, has to do with animal flesh, right? We have carnivore, which has to do with the eating of the flesh of animals. We have the word carnitine. Carnitine is a compound naturally produced in the body and thus consumed when you eat flesh. And let's be honest, most people are eating animal flesh, not human flesh. So, for instance, L-carnitine, which is one of the types of this compound, L-carnitine is an amino acid found in meat because it's found in flesh and required by carnivores. It's something that we've talked about when we talk about cats, for instance, being obligate carnivores, flesh eaters. They need to have carnitine, which is this amino L-carnitine specifically, which is this amino acid that is found in flesh, animal flesh. The word carrion, we have that word for the dead flesh of animals, such as when we say a vulture is eating its carrion, or we call a vulture or other kind of carrion birds. It's because they eat the, dead flesh. And of course, from other languages, we have reference to animal flesh-based dishes like carnitas, which is a meat-based dish from Mexico, meaning little meats, carnitas. And then we have chili con carne, which is a spicy meat and bean-based stew, either from Mexico or from Texas, probably more Tex-Mex, meaning literally chilies with meat, chili con carne, and charcuterie. Charcuterie is a French word meaning cooked meat. However, there are words with that root carn, meaning flesh, that refers to human flesh as well as non-human flesh. And I just want to call these out because not every word that has carn in it has to do specifically with animal, non-human animal flesh. We also have those like carnal. Carnal just relates to the body in general, something physical, and especially something sexual, appetite. Sorry, we talk about carnal desires, I mean, desires of the flesh, right? That's carnal. Incarnate, meaning to be invested with bodily nature or embodied in human form, like a villain who is evil incarnate. That's evil personified in the flesh, right? Incarnate. Reincarnation, meaning the rebirth of the soul in another human or non-human body in this case as well. Reincarnation. Charnel, we talked about this, I think, a bit in a previous episode. It's a bit of an archaic term. It comes from the word for flesh, meaning a repository for the bones or bodies of the dead, like a charnel house. Carnage, refers to the slaughter or massacre of a great number of people, such as the carnage after a plane crash or a car accident or a gunman's attack or war. Now, while it tends to refer mostly to the massacre of people, it can be used to refer to the large slaughter of animals as well. Now, interestingly, the word carnage in English came from French carnage and meant a piece of meat used as bait. So I do think the early origins of the word carnage really referred to more of animal flesh, non-human animal flesh, but we do use the word carnage to refer to both. Now, carnation is a word that has the root carn in it, right? So I thought I would just call your attention to this, because as you start to think about these words, this one might have come to mind. So the origins of this word carnation, referring to the flower, are a bit muddled. The early forms are confused. It's perhaps on evidence of early spellings, a corruption of coronation, C-O-R-O-N-A-T-I-O-N, coronation, possibly from the flower's crown-like look of the petals. They have these toothed crown-like petals, the carnations do. It's possible the flower is called such because of its pinkness and derives from Middle English carnation, meaning a person's color or complexion, the flesh color. Now, of course, this is referring only to some people's flesh color. Certainly only Caucasians would have that color, and not all people. But is a possible derivation? Is it referring to the flesh color, this pinkish color of some people's skin color? But because not all carnations are that light pink or flesh color, it's not really certain that that's where the origins were. But I thought you would ask, so I thought I would tell you. It's most likely from the misspelling of coronation. But there you have it. We have the word carnation. But deep in the roots of our modern word carnival is the removing or putting away of consuming animal flesh as food. May we enjoy carnivals every single day. Moving on to another word with animal flesh in its origins is the word shambles. Now, you've heard of the word shambles. You've talked about the shambles if you've ever used the word to refer to something that's in complete disarray. And if you listen to my podcast from a few years ago, probably several years ago now, I talked about it in the context of my visit to the city of York in the north of England. A shambles is a place or scene of carrion and carnage. See what I did there? See what I did there? They're both. Right. Because the original meaning refers to a butcher's slaughterhouse. It comes from the Middle English word shamel or shamelhouse, a place where meat is butchered and sold, coming from the Old English word for table, which comes from the Latin scabilium or scamilium, which means bench or stool. Now that seems innocent enough, but by the Middle Ages, it referred literally to the table or low bench or stool or shelves on which butchers displayed their cuts of animal flesh. The shambles is a little street in York called such because it was the street on which there were most of the butcher shops. It's the oldest street in York. It was mentioned in the Domesday Book of William the Conqueror in 1086. So it's over 900 years old, this street is. And I hate to think about how many animals were butchered over these many years. Many of the buildings on the street date back to the late 14th and 15th century, which is around 1350 to 1475. And in the 1870s, there were 25 butcher shops. Today, thank goodness, there are no more. Other market towns and other cities also have areas called the Shambles, and the one in York is now a tourist area and probably the most famous. Speaking of slaughter, the word slaughter itself refers to slaughter. So the word slaughter, of course, refers to the killing of animals, especially for human consumption. Or it could mean to the killing, it could mean the killing of a large number of people. It could refer to, I was going to say, the killing of a large number of people. It's a massacre, right? Which creates, as you know, a great deal of carnage. The word itself comes into English in around 1300 from Old Norse and Icelandic slaughter. I'm not going to be able to pronounce this. I don't know what the original Old Norse would be, but the spelling is S-L-A-T-R, meaning a butchering or butcher meat, and Norwegian dialect slaughter, which meant cattle for killing. Now you can see why I called this episode what I did. It is all gut-wrenching. This is literally gut-wrenching. So while the word slaughter means the killing or butchering of animals for human consumption, the origins of the word itself connote that as well. The word slaughter comes from the word that means the killing of animals. And that's what you can see is this foundation of this episode. That's what I thought was so fascinating about these words and why I put them in their own theme here in this episode. Now, something that might come out of the shambles as a result of slaughter, in addition to garbage, is a clear jelly, typically made of stock and gelatin and used as glaze or garnish or to make a mold of meat, fish, or vegetables. And that's something called aspic. Basically, it's meat jelly. It's gelatin. Now, I don't think aspic is a very common term for most people outside of the culinary world, probably, or people who study old molds. Though when I asked David if he's ever used the word or heard of the word, he immediately said, yeah, it's the name of an album by the band King Crimson. The album is called Lark's Tongue in Aspic. So a pretty obscure way to know that word. But I looked it up a bit, like why the band members chose that. And it's pretty cryptic in their response. I think they may have chosen it just for the rhythmic sound of the phrase itself, Lark's Tongue in Aspic. And it is a fascinating phrase, but it was a thing, like lark's tongue in aspic, or lots of animal parts in aspic was a thing, especially by monarchs and nobility in Europe and Asia. There are historical reports of thousands of lark's tongues in aspic being eaten at Versailles in one sitting, which is no surprise. And during the 1970s, it actually made a return because of like Nouvelle Cuisine as a delicacy in Nouvelle Cuisine, but it was mocked and derided as an indication of how silly the new cuisine was and how unappealing lark's tongue in aspic is. So where does the word aspic come from and why did I choose it? I'm not just choosing words that are animal products. And, you know, I'm choosing words that are from animal parts, but also whose origins of the words themselves have to do with animals. So in this case, the word aspic seems to have come into English in the 1780s. It's first attested in writing in 1789 from French aspic, which itself comes from the old French word asp, as in the venomous snake, whose cold blooded metabolism makes them seem cool to the touch. There's even a French proverbial phrase, I'm not going to try and say it in French, that translates to cold as an asp, referring to the cold temperature of a snake. Now, how is it that we came to refer to this meat jelly as aspic, having to do with asps, the snake? Is it the cold temperature when molded? You have to put it in the refrigerator, and the cold mold that is made with aspic resembles the coldness of an asp because they're cold-blooded? Possibly. Could it be because of the resemblance of the jelly's color to an asp? Possibly. Or could it be something else entirely? Possibly. There's only speculation at this point, but I wanted to pass that speculation on to you. But what we do know is that asp, the snake, is the root of the word aspic. I doubt they used snakes to create the aspic itself, but they certainly did use other animals, that's for sure. So that I thought was interesting. And another word that has to do with gelatin, both actually and etymologically, is the word isinglass. Now, most people don't know this word. I think most vegans know this word because as you start to look at what things have animal products and what these animal products are, you discover that there's this thing called isinglass that's used as a clarifying agent for beverages and some other things. And so isinglass is a transparent, almost pure gelatin. It's talked about as a pure gelatin prepared from the air bladders of some freshwater fishes, especially sturgeon. It's used in cooking for making jellies, also for clarifying liquors, in the manufacture of glue, and for other purposes. The earliest written record of it in English is in the mid-1500s, apparently as a perversion of Dutch. Let me see if I can even say this. Huissenblaas, right? Something like that. Literally sturgeon bladder. From Huissen, sturgeon, plus blas, which is bladder. It comes from the Proto-Germanic, it wouldn't be the exact pronunciation of this, but B-L-E-S, a Proto-Germanic word that meant to blow. And that would be called such because the substance was obtained from the air bladders of these fishes. So that's the origin, but that's literally what it means. The word isinglass, it's not just that isinglass comes from animals, it's that the word isinglass is built from words that denote animals. Does that make sense? And so that's another word referring not only to the stuff made from animal body parts, but the word itself is made from the same. Moving on to a few more words. We have a few more words having animal flesh in their origins that you would never know. You would never know by looking at them. And they're fascinating. And those would be words I'm going to tell you about in a moment, but I want to first thank my amazing supporters. That might be you. Thank you, and you, and you, and I can see you right there trying to hide, but thank you, all of you, for supporting this podcast. Thank you, Brooke Bussard, Jennifer Stattmiller, Michal Stone, David Cabrera, Alexander Gray. Thank you to Becky Peters, who increased her pledge again. And thank you to our new supporters, Karen Detling, Molly Bosom, Rebecca Calloway, Samantha Bernasconi. Was it Samantha? Maybe there's not an H there. I think I copied and pasted it exactly how I saw it. So it might be Samantha, so forgive me. Bernasconi and Melissa Knighton. Thank you to everyone at every level for supporting this podcast. Every bit you support supports this work, supports the all the work I do. I just had another KQED radio perspective, an editorial I contribute to KQED. I'm working a lot on wildlife issues here in Oakland. All of that is because you support the work. You support this work, like literally. Like there's no, I don't have a boss. I don't have an HR department. There's no payroll. You're it. Like, that's it. So thank you to everybody at every level. And remember, supporters at $10 a month and above receive written transcripts to every Food for Thought episode. And at $20 a month and above, you get an audio recording of a loving kindness meditation I made last year for you. Perks are being added all the time, but just know that you are supporting this work. If you're getting anything out of this podcast in particular or my work in general, please become a supporter today. Consider becoming a supporter today. You can go to patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau. You can just go to joyfulvegan.com also and click on the donate button. You can find it over there. So in keeping with our theme today, a couple more words whose origins hide their animal flesh and guts and ugh, it's terrible, is a word actually that you would probably never use. You would use it if you study ancient Rome. You would have heard of it if you studied ancient Rome. And that's haruspex. That's haruspex. And that's a good way to split up the word because it actually comes from two different words. The word haruspex is the name for a priest or soothsayer in ancient Rome, actually of Etruscan origin, who practiced divination by the inspection of the entrails, the guts, gut-wrenching, hence the name of today's episode, of animals. Now, I talked about this phenomena in a podcast episode, even in a QED radio editorial when I talked about the ancient practice of reading the auspices. So you can go check out an etymology episode called, I can't remember the exact title, something to do with inauguration, because that has to do with the same root having to do with birds, reading the auspices, inauguration, haruspex. It all has to do with divination in ancient Rome. Coming into English in the late 1500s, the word haruspex has its roots in the Proto-Indo-European root G-H-E-R-E, meaning gut or entrail. You see why this is like, that's why I was like really struggling with what to call this episode, because like, I didn't want to call it blood and guts. I didn't want to call it flesh and blood. Like, I want people to listen to it, and I don't want to turn them off, but I also want to be accurate. So gut, like guts have a lot to do with entrails, intestines, like that has a lot to do with today's episode. So this word haruspex has its roots in the Proto-Indo-European root. Now, again, remember these Proto-Indo-European roots, we don't have any remnants of Proto-Indo-European. This was built from words that we have now, and linguists built this language based on word changes. So we can't say for sure, but these Proto-Indo-European roots, and we don't know how they would have been pronounced, but it appears to have been a Proto-Indo-European root, G-H-E-R-E, which means gut and entrail, plus the Latin word spec, meaning beholding or inspecting, that comes from, you know, the Latin word we get spectacles and spectator, that for seeing, for witnessing, for inspecting. That's what that other part of the word comes from, for a haruspex, inspecting the entrails. And so we get haruspex. Now we've got another word that has to do with entrails, both in actuality and etymology. And that's a little more obvious because you'd see it and you'd go, is that a thing? And that's the word catgut. Now this is a tough, thin cord made from the treated and stretched intestines of certain animals, especially sheep, and used for stringing musical instruments and tennis rackets and for surgical ligatures. Now, catgut makers usually use sheep or goat intestines, but occasionally they use other animals and cattle, like pigs and horses and donkeys. Now, despite the name, catgut manufacturers do not use cat intestines, but it's bad enough that they're using other animals' intestines. Attested in English in the 1500s, it appears to come from a Dutch word, catadarm, and so far as the name can be traced back, it distinctly means guts or intestines of the cat, even though it's not known if they were ever used for this purpose. The word catgut may have been an abbreviation of the word cattle gut. Now, the word gut, of course, just means entrails or intestines. That's why I keep using those words interchangeably. In anticipation of your questions, today, most musical instruments use strings that are made from synthetic materials, steel or synthetic polymer. Gut strings, even if they're called gut strings, they are most likely synthetic. So ask. A lot of people who do play Baroque string instruments, some of them do want the animal catgut. And so I'm sure there are some musicians who choose that. But you would be able to find most instruments without, or if you are a professional, I mean, you can probably get them made without. As for catgut used for sutures, that was also once widely used, and it's possibly still used in developing countries because it's cheaper, but it tends to be synthetic or cotton at this point. And then finally, as far as tennis rackets, again, same thing. Most are synthetic these days, but you can ask and find out. And I know you'd never think that you'd have to ask for something like that. Could I please have a tennis racket that doesn't have intestines? Thank you very much. Like, who would ever think that you'd have to ask that? But, you know, for a long time in the Middle Ages, animal parts, and as we know, were used for so many things, and we're seeing remnants of that today. Now, moving on to two final words whose origins are rooted in animal flesh and guts and fluids that will blow your mind. Are you ready? I'm really not trying to keep you in suspense. It's going to blow your mind. The first word is pudding. Now, the modern usage of the word pudding denotes mostly sweet desserts, especially in the United States and some parts of Canada, where it denotes a sweet milk-based dessert, similar in consistency to a custard, whether that custard is egg-based or, in our case, I have puddings that are cornstarch-based, and all the commercial custards in the UK, the most famous of which, that it is a cornstarch-based custard, so it doesn't have to have eggs. But the point is, that's what we think of when we think of puddings, but the word has evolved over time from when it originally almost exclusively was used to describe savory dishes, specifically those created using a process similar to that used for sausages, in which meat, animal flesh, and other ingredients in mostly liquid form are encased and then steamed or boiled to set the contents. Black pudding, suet pudding, Yorkshire pudding, steak and kidney pudding, and haggis survive from this tradition. And those who are listening from the UK know exactly what I'm talking about. In fact, the earliest puddings were essentially sausages. Puddings are a British invention that were developed from the sausages the Romans brought into the country in the first century BC. And from there, we get our etymology. The word pudding comes from the Latin word botulus, which literally means sausage. And the French word boudin has the same root. Now, pudding came into English in the 13th century. And as the OED talks about, the source was probably an Anglo-Norman word, boudin, same thing, coming in from French, coming in from Norman French, which meant sausage. In the plural, it referred to animal intestines or entrails. Now, when pudding came into English, as I said, in the 13th century, the B changed to P. And if you want to know more about those changes that happened, those sound changes that happened, you can go listen to Etymology and I talk all about that. So when that word came into English, when pudding came into English, boudin, or it would have been, you know, Latin botulus to French boudin, came into English, became pudding, the B changed to a P. It meant stuffed entrails. It meant sausage. That's what it meant. And as the OED defines it, pudding originally meant the stomach or one of the entrails, in early use sometimes the neck, of a pig, sheep, or other animal stuffed with a mixture of minced meat, suet, which is the fat, oatmeal, seasoning, etc., and then boiled. The English word was first recorded in 1287 as puddings in Norwich City documents that were otherwise rendered in Latin. So a pudding continued to mean a sausage until well into the 19th century, and many English speakers will use the word that way today. So even though you wouldn't know it to look at it, especially those of us who are not in the UK, at the root of the word pudding is the entrails or intestines of an animal stuffed into a casing and eaten. Can you believe people even do that? So the word just changed over time to refer now to many things, including, as we would know it, the sweet custard, the sweet cornstarch thickened dessert. The second word whose roots I said will blow your mind, I think, I don't know, have all of them blown your mind? I think it's fascinating and says a lot about our word history and our treatment of animals, is a word that also etymologically and actually are rooted in animals, and that is the word ketchup. This is another foodstuff whose original recipe and meaning is different than what we associate it with today. For us today, especially in the West, ketchup is a condiment consisting of a thick, smooth, textured, spicy sauce, usually made from tomatoes. But originally, it was a sauce made from fermented fish. And though you wouldn't know that unless you know Middle Chinese, it comes from a Chinese word, kitsiap, whose characters combine to mean pickled fish plus juice or sauce or brine. So it's it's pickled fish juice. According to the OED, the word ketchup first appears in English in the 17th century with reference to a type of sauce encountered by British travelers and traders and colonists in Southeast Asia, who then introduced them to Britain. Similar sauces referred to as ketchups appear from the 18th century using a variety of ingredients. This is in Great Britain at this time, including anchovies, mushrooms, walnuts, and oysters being particularly popular. Now, according to the website Spruce Eats, those English settlers who brought mushroom ketchup to America came from the East, went to Great Britain, and then to the United States, North America, where it continued to gradually go through various changes. One significant alteration was the addition of tomatoes, which of course is a crop from South America, brought to Mexico, came into North America. And so tomatoes were added to what was originally kind of this fish and then, you know, kind of anchovies and mushrooms in the UK and then brought here, and tomatoes were added. There is a recipe from 1801 in a cookery book called the Sugar House Book, and it called for squeezing the tomatoes dry and then salting and boiling them and then pressing them through a sieve, and then you add mace and nutmeg and allspice and cloves and cinnamon and ginger and pepper, and then you boil it and you thicken it and you cool it and you bottle it. And so that's how ketchup as we kind of know it today came to be ketchup. Originally, unripe tomatoes were used, which required the addition of a preservative called sodium benzoate, which prevented spoilage and it prevented loss of flavor. But in the early 1900s, the Food and Drug Administration banned the use of this additive, and Heinz, which was one of the early companies, not the first one, but one of the early companies making ketchup, began making their ketchup with ripe tomatoes, which just contain a natural preservative, pectin, and then adding sugar and vinegar so it preserved it more naturally. Due to the increased amount of pectin, the resulting ketchup was thicker than the watery previous version. When I think of kind of the original ketchup, especially from the East, but even as it started developing, I do think of a much thinner, kind of more soy saucy kind of consistency than the thick condiment we have today. And so now we have it. We have a condiment that 97% of Americans have in their homes, but the original concoction, as well as the word itself, included fermented fish. And there you have it. Garbage, carnival, carnivore, carnitine, carrion, carnitas, charcuterie, shambles, slaughter, aspic, isinglass, haruspex, catgut, pudding, and ketchup, words you wouldn't necessarily know were related to the gut-wrenching act of animal slaughter and animal consumption. But there you have it, both in the origin of the words themselves and in the origin of these acts, we have these words today that you wouldn't know. Garbage, carnival, carnivore, you've already figured out. You would have already been mindful of that. But carnitine, carrion, obviously obvious, carnitas, charcuterie. But I'm fascinated by garbage, carnival, shambles. You would have maybe not heard of if you hadn't listened to that episode. The word slaughter is obvious, but did you know that the word itself comes from the word meaning slaughter? So garbage again, carnival, garbage, carnival, shambles, isinglass, pudding, and ketchup. Words you would not necessarily know were related to the slaughter of animals, but indeed are. So I hope you find that interesting. I certainly do. It certainly says a lot, again, about our relationship with, our regard for, or lack of regard for, or use of other animals. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can share them over at joyfulvegan.com. I look forward to hearing from you. Until then, for the animals, this is Colleen Patrick-Gaudreau. Thank you for listening.